Are you looking to take your knowledge of Egypt to the next level? You've come to the right place. Welcome to Eric's Guide to Ancient Egypt with your host, historian and Egyptology PhD grad from UCLA, Eric.
Hello and welcome to this episode of Eric's Guide to Ancient Egypt. And today we're going to be talking about the myth of Horus and Seth. Now, many of you are probably no doubt familiar with the god Horus. He's often depicted as a falcon. He's a god who's associated with the pharaoh, with kingship. He's the son of Osiris and Isis. So he's one of our most famous gods. And Seth is a pretty famous god too, although a little bit more obscure. And in this tale, we see a battle between these two figures over the rule of ancient Egypt. And it's really fascinating because one of the things about ancient Egypt that makes it really actually difficult to construct these kind of myths and to put them all together is the fact that the Egyptians really didn't write a lot of these things down. You know, one of the things that we see with Horus and Seth is we already see allusions to them much, much earlier, thousands of years before we actually have the story I'm going to go over with you today, which is from a papyrus from the New Kingdom, Chester Beatty 1, which gives us, we don't unfortunately have the entire tale, but we have a lot of the different episodes of these kind of two gods fighting amongst each other. But we already have representations of these two gods together. Sometimes they're shown as unifying the two lands. So the two lands being Upper and Lower Egypt. So sometimes the rule is shown as being split between the two of them. Seth rules one part of Egypt, Horus rules another, but together they unite it. And then we'll kind of see the story, you know, here, which is a slightly different take on that. Now, before going on, first I kind of have to just really quickly run through a couple gods who are going to be some main players in this story. So the first is actually a set of gods called the Aeneid. And the Aeneid just means nine, and this is a group of nine gods in ancient Egypt. The main god is Atum or Atum Re. Now, one of the things that kind of makes some of the different gods challenging is the fact that gods will turn into other gods, they'll be associated with other gods. But for the Aeneid, we're talking about Atum or Atum Re, who is the creator god of Heliopolis, the city of the sun, which is under modern Cairo. He brings himself into being in a story that itself is long and detailed, and I'd like to devote to a podcast later. But after bringing himself into being, he has two children, Shu and Tefnut. And these are a male and female pair of gods. And these two gods kind of create space. So prior to the creation of the world, we just have these kind of chaotic waters, this nothingness. But after the god brings himself into existence, he then creates these two gods, which create a kind of space for him to live in, a space within the chaotic waters of this primordial time. And those two gods go on to have two children of their own, Geb and Nut. Geb is a male god. He's the god of the earth. Nut, a female goddess, the goddess of the sky. So now we've got this space within these chaotic waters. We've got the earth and the sky created. And then those gods actually go on to have four children, Isis and Osiris, who form a kind of couple, and Seth and the goddess Nephthys, who kind of form a couple. So these group of nine gods are the Aeneid. Now, trouble really starts when Geb and Nut have more than just two children. Because now, all of a sudden we have a fight for more than one heir. And what ends up happening, and at least in the story that we have handed down, is that Seth is jealous that his brother Osiris, the older brother, is the ruler of the earth, so he kills him. Osiris is brought back to life, but he can only exist in the netherworld. So he's no longer the ruler of this world and this realm. He's the ruler of the netherworld. And Seth then takes Osiris's place. So Seth is kind of ruling the country. And that's right where our story kind of picks up. Now, we see that a couple different things happen within this story. And the papyrus I'll kind of be reading from a little bit later on, that actually has a bunch of different kind of, I guess, satirical stories that happen along this kind of whole long myth complex. But what's important to remember about myths is that myths actually say something about the people who create them. You know, a myth is meant not just to be an entertaining story, although that's certainly part of it, but a myth is meant to give some kind of deeper meaning. It's meant to give some insight into the current reality. That reality might be the nature of the seasons. You know, why it's colder in winter, why the days are shorter. It might be, this is why the current king rules. It might be, this is how our city was founded. But when you think about myths, they all have those kind of things. They all say something about the people who created them. So, in our time, following this myth, what we've seen is that kingship has passed on from Atum to Shu to Geb, then to Osiris. Seth has become jealous. He kills him. And then he takes over the throne. Now, at this time, according to the story, there is no actual son. There is no one to take over from Osiris. It's Isis, great of magic, who finds Osiris. Now, Osiris isn't simply killed. His body is chopped up and spread all throughout Egypt. So she actually goes throughout the country, attempting to find his pieces. She finds all his pieces except for his penis. Luckily, she's got powerful magic, so she's able to create a penis for him. And then, of course, what does she do? She has sex with her dead husband. He's brought back to life. She becomes pregnant with the god Horus. He, as I said before, has to remain in the netherworld. He can't come into this world. But Isis is now conceived an heir. But she knows that if Seth finds her, Seth is gonna kill the child. So she goes into hiding in order to give birth and to protect Horus. So Horus eventually is born. And that's where we're gonna jump into our story here. He's born, grows up kind of in secret. He's grown up and he goes before the Aeneid in order to stake his claim. So he goes forward to all those gods. And he says to them, so he goes before all of these gods. Now, as I said before, the papyrus I'm taking this story from, we don't have it necessarily fully complete. So where it picks up, he's before all of these gods. He's before the Aeneid. So Horus has come before this tribunal of gods. And we don't know exactly what he says. And kind of when the text picks up, we have the god Shu, right? And he's, remember, you know, one of those early gods, the first set of gods created after Atum created himself. And he says, "Justice is a possessor of power. Award the office to Horus." So that office, of course, is the office of kingship. Now, that main Aeneid is the one there, but we've also got a lot of other gods here as well. One of those is Thoth, the god of writing, god of magic, and he echoes what Shu says. He says, "It is correct a million times." Now, Isis is overjoyed at hearing this. She lets out a shriek. She comes before them all, and she says, "North wind, go to the west, impart the good news to her husband Osiris." So Shu then says, "The one who presents the uninjured eye is loyal to the Aeneid." Now, the Universal Lord, as he's called in this story, is really upset by this. He says, "Indeed, what is the meaning of your exercising authority alone by yourselves?" Another god responds to him. "He shall assume the cartouche of Horus and the white crown shall be placed upon his head. And the Universal Lord is upset. He's furious at this because the Universal Lord, who we should really read here as being a form of Rey, wants Seth to have the office. Now, while he's sitting there kind of stewing, Seth says, "Have Horus dismissed outside with me, that I may let you see my hand prevail over his hand in the presence of the Aeneid, since there is not known any other method of dispossessing him." So Seth wants to fight. And this is a hallmark of Seth. Seth is an extremely powerful figure. He's powerful both in body, he's powerful in battle. And this is pretty much the hallmark of him. He's not a very intelligent god, as you'll kind of see as our story goes on. But this is what he's kind of known for, his strength. So he wants martial combat to be the decider of who gets to keep the land. Now, Thoth responds to Seth, "Shouldn't we ascertain who the imposter really is? It is while Osiris's son Horus is still living that his office should be awarded to Seth." So now we see that the All-Lord really becomes furious at this. And again, we should read this All-Lord as being a manifestation of Rey. So he lets out a loud shriek before the Aeneid, saying he wishes to give the office to Seth. Now Atum comes in and he says, "Have this other god, Ban-Neb-Jedah, the great and living god, judge between the two youths." So Ban-Neb-Jedah comes in and he's brought before the Aeneid, and they tell him, "Judge between these two youths and stop them from being engaged so and quarreling every day." Thereupon Ban-Neb-Jedah answers them and says, "Do not have us exercise our authority ignorantly. Let a letter be sent to Neith, the great, the god's mother. As for what she will say, we shall do it." So Ban-Neb-Jedah is kind of passing the buck a little bit to a powerful goddess Neith and saying, "You know, look, we're debating here. Let's not act too hastily. Let's ask this goddess what she thinks." So they send her a letter. And then the goddess Neith writes back to them. And she says, "For the office of Osiris to his son Horus. Do not commit since blatant acts of iniquity, which are illegal, or I shall become so furious that the sky will touch the ground. The Universal Lord, the bull who resides in Heliopolis, ought to be told, enrich Seth in his possessions, give him Anat and Astarte, your two daughters, and install Horus in the position of his father Osiris." So here we have, again, another one wanting to give the office to Horus. And so her letter arrives. It's read before the entire Aeneid, and they all unanimously declare, "This goddess is correct." All of them, of course, except the Universal Lord. He says to them, "You are despicable in your person, and this office is too much for you. You lad, the flavor in whose mouth is still bad." So here he's addressing not the Aeneid, but Horus. He's really dressing him down. He's saying, "You can't handle this office." Now here, the god Anuris steps in and becomes furious at the All-Lord. And he goes up and he stands and he tells him, "Your shrine is vacant." So he's insulting the god, telling him, "You know, look, you know, no one's going to worship you. There's no one, there's nothing in your shrine. You're not a just god." So the god becomes so offended, he leaves. He takes off. He's going to take his ball and go home. He's not happy at all that the gods are fighting him on this so much. And, you know, perhaps here we can give you a little bit of information why he's fighting him so much. Here, right, when we're talking about this Universal Lord, we're talking about a manifestation of Rey. And what you have to remember about Rey is that Rey dies every day. Every day at sunset, Rey is swallowed up by the sky. He dies, and traveling through the netherworld, he goes through, is eventually met with Osiris. Osiris lends him his creative, rejuvenated powers. Ray is reborn, resurrected, and then he's able to be reborn the next day. But at the critical moment, or I should say one of the critical moments, after his resurrection, he has to fight the god Apophis. Apophis is a huge snake who wants to destroy all of creation. And it's actually not Rey who destroys Apophis, because Rey is weak. It's the god Seth. So the universal lord here, this manifestation of Rey, wants to keep Seth happy, because without Seth, he very likely is going to be destroyed by Apophis. So he's got a very good, albeit a very selfish reason for wanting to keep Seth happy, and to keep Seth in his office. That office being, of course, the office of kingship. So he's just been insulted. He decides to leave. And here is one of these things. I can't tell you how many times, you know, I've gone over this with other Egyptologists, and it's kind of funny, but there's a lot of sex in this story, as we'll see, and a lot of it to us just doesn't make sense. So the god basically goes home to pout. He goes into his tent. And in fact, the Aeneid all kind of go back to their huts. And after a bit of time, the goddess Hathor, who's a goddess, think of her kind of like a Venus or an Aphrodite. She's a goddess of love. She's a goddess of fertility. And as the text says, Hathor, lady of the southern sycamore, came and stood behind her before her father, the universal lord. And she exposed her vagina before his very eyes. Thereupon the great lord laughed at her. Then he got up and sat down with the great Aeneid. He said to Horus and Seth, "Speak concerning yourselves." So what rouses him from his kind of pouting is his daughter, who just basically goes in and flashes him. I mean, that's what the story says. What exactly that means, you know, sometimes I think it might mean kind of, you know, like a little, you know, 2-year-old who takes off all their clothes and runs around naked. It's supposed to be something comical. But this is Hathor. She's a goddess of love and sexuality, and she's also, you know, an adult. So it's a little bit, you know, it's a little bit hard to tell exactly what they're meaning by here. But nonetheless, it works. It cheers him up. So he then goes back to the Aeneid, tells Seth and Horus, okay, plead your cases. So Seth speaks first. He says, "As for me, I am Seth, greatest in virility among the Aeneid, for I slay the opponent of Rey daily while I am at the prow of the bark of millions." The bark of millions is the name of the solar bark, the bark, the boat that Rey rides in as he goes across the sky and through the netherworld. "Whereas not any other god is able to do it, I should receive the office of Osiris." So here, right, Seth just cuts to the quick, and he says, "Look, I'm the one among you, the only one among you, who's strong enough to defeat Apophis. So I should have the office of Osiris. I'm the strongest." And the Aeneid all say, you know, Seth, the son of Nut, is right about this. But then Thoth and the god Onuris let out a great cry, and they say, "Is it while a bodily son is still living that the office is to be awarded to a maternal uncle?" And then the god Banabjeda comes back, the one who wrote to Neith, and he says, "Is it while Seth, his older brother, is still living that the office is to be awarded to a mere lad?" Then the Aeneid lets out a long cry before the face of the universal lord, and they say to him, "What is the meaning of the words that you have said, which are unfit to be heard?" So here again, we have this tension, right? We have the idea, and this is really what this story is about. Should the ruler of your country be the one who's the strongest, who's perhaps the best able to rule? Or should it be passed down from father to son, regardless of the age or the strength of that son? So you can see here, in a courtroom-type setting, this tribunal is battling this out. So then Horus says, "It is no good this cheating me in the presence of the Aeneid and depriving me of the office of my father." And thereupon Isis became furious at the Aeneid and took the oath of the gods, took an oath by the gods in the Aeneid and said, "By my mother Neith, the goddess, and by Ta Tenen with lofty plumes, who curbs the hordes of the gods, these matters should be submitted before Atum, the great prince who is in Heliopolis, and also before Khepri, who rides in his bark." And the Aeneid all kind of sees how upset Isis is, and they try to calm her down. "Don't become angry," they say. "The rights will be given to the one who is in the right. All that you have said will be done." So now Seth becomes furious at this. And he says, "I shall take my scepter of 4,500 Nesem weights, and I shall kill you all one a day." And then Seth takes an oath by the All Lord, saying, "I shall not go to law in the tribunal while Isis is still in it." So here we kind of see some of this tension. Again, Seth is not the strongest, but he is not the smartest, rather, but he is the strongest. Isis is clever. So he doesn't want to argue against Isis. He thinks that that's going to sway it against him. So he says, basically, "I'm going to kill one of you a day, and I'm not going to participate in this tribunal as long as she's here." And they again kind of acquiesce. And they say, "You shall ferry across to the island in the middle and decide between them there. And tell Nemti the ferryman not to ferry any woman across resembling Isis." So they say, "Okay, you know, we're not going to make Isis leave, but, you know, all of you in the Aeneid, we're all of us in this tribunal, we're going to go to an island. We're not going to let Isis go, and we're going to decide there." Now, of course, Isis is going to find a way to go there, right? So Isis goes to Nemti, the ferryman, who's sitting in his boat. And she's transformed herself into the body of an old woman who's kind of walking, you know, with a limp. And she goes to him and says, "Might you ferry me across the island in the middle, to the island in the middle? Because it is for a young lad that I have come carrying a bowl full of porridge, since he has been tending some cattle on the island in the middle for 5 days now and is hungry." So she's nice, right? A nice elderly woman wants to go feed a poor young boy who's over there herding some cattle. But Nemti's got his order, so he says, "I have been told not to ferry any woman across." But then she said to him, "Well, wasn't that with reference to Isis that you have been told not to do this?" And he says to her, "What will you give me that you may be ferried across to the island in the middle?" And she says to him, "I'll give you this cake." To which he replies, "What good is this to me, your cake? Is it in exchange for your cake that I should ferry you across the island in the middle when I have been told not to ferry any woman across?" She then says to him, "I will give you the gold signet ring which is on my hand." He says, "Hand over the golden signet ring." She gives it to him, and he ferries her across to the island. Now, once upon the island, she's walking and she sees where the Aeneid is sitting before the All Lord, and they're all there kind of in his camp. And Seth looks and saw her from afar, but then she conjures herself into a beautiful young woman. And as the text says, transforming herself into a maiden whose body was beautiful and whose like did not exist upon the entire land. And thereupon he desired her most lecherously. Seth got right up from sitting, eating bread with the great Aeneid, and proceeded to overtake her, no one having seen her except for himself. Then he stood behind a sycamore tree and called to her. He said to her, "I am here with you, beautiful maiden." And she said to him, "Respect, my great lord. As for me, I am a wife living with a cattleman to whom I bore a son. My husband died, and the lad started tending his father's cattle. But then a stranger came and settled in my stable. He has thus, in speaking to my son, said, 'I shall beat you and confiscate your father's cattle and evict you.' said he in speaking to him, and now it is my desire to have you afford him your protection. So here Isis is claiming to be a beautiful, well, she's showing herself as a beautiful young widow whose son is being beaten and mistreated by a man who's come in and taken over the possessions of her dead husband. And she's asking him for protection. And Seth says to her, "Is it while the son of a male is still living that the cattle are to be given to a stranger?" And upon hearing this, Isis transforms herself into a bird and flies to the top of an acacia tree. And she then calls out to Seth, "Be ashamed by yourself. It is by your own mouth that you have judged yourself. It is by your own cleverness that you have been judged. What comeback do you have now?" Right? So what she did was essentially just describe the exact same situation that Horus and Seth are in, and said, you know, "Look, this is what happened." And Seth says, "Oh, this isn't right. You know, I'll protect you." So Isis, again, is clever. She's tricked him. Seth is really a character with more testosterone than brains. He falls for it. And now again, we see, you know, Seth upset. So he goes back to the camp, and the All-Lord says to him, "What's bothering you still?" And Seth says, "That wicked woman has come to me again. She has tricked me again, having transformed herself into a beautiful maiden before my eyes. She said to me, 'As for me, I was a wife living with a cattleman. He died, I bore him a son who is now tending some of his father's cattle. A stranger took lodging in my stable with my son, and I gave him meals. Now, after many days following this, the visitor said to my son, 'I shall beat you and confiscate your father's cattle, and they will become mine.' He said in speaking to my son, 'So she said to me.'" Then the All-Lord says, "Well, what did you say to her?" And Seth tells him, "I said to her, 'It is while the son of the male that is still living that the cattle are to be given to a stranger.' So I said to her, 'This visitor's face should be smitten with a rod, and he should be evicted, and your son put in his father's position.' This is what I said to her." So upon hearing this, the universal Lord says, "Look here, it is by yourself that you have judged yourself. What comeback do you have now?" Now Seth, of course, has now just been told by the one person who's been supporting him throughout this, "Look, you've judged yourself, you messed up." So, you know, he has to turn his anger somewhere. So he says, "Have Nemti the ferryman brought and severe punishment inflicted upon him, saying, 'Why did you let her be ferried across?'" So Nemti is brought, and they remove the front of his feet, and they told him, "Gold shall be, because of me, an abomination unto my city." So here we have, right, that instance where myth kind of helps to explain a reality, and this is explaining the region where Nemti's from. This city has a taboo against gold, going back to this story. So this story is weaving in kind of one of these characteristics of this god in this city. Now, after a time, the All-Lord and Atum and the Aeneid are sitting there, and the gods write them. They write them and they say, "What are you still doing here? As for these two youths, you will have them finishing their lifetime in the tribunal. When my letter reaches you, you shall place the white crown upon the head of Horus, son of Isis, and appoint him to the position of his father." So now, of course, Seth becomes furious again, and he says, and the Aeneid says to Seth, "Why have you become so furious? Isn't it in accordance with what Atum, lord of the two lands, and the All-Lord have said should be carried out, that we are carrying this out?" So then the white crown, the crown of Upper Egypt, is placed upon the head of Horus. So Seth lets out a loud shriek and says, "Is it while I am still living as his elder brother that the office is to be awarded to my younger brother?" So here we see the gods have finally acted. Seth is furious. But again, right, he takes another oath. "The white crown shall be removed from the head of Horus, son of Isis, and he shall be thrown into the water in order that I may contend with him over the office of ruler." And the All-Lord acquiesces. Seth finally is going to get his trial by combat. So thereupon, Seth says to Horus, "Come, let's both transform ourselves into hippopotamuses and submerge into the deep water in the midst of the sea." Now, as for the one who shall emerge within the span of 3 whole months, the office should not be awarded to him. So they both submerged, and Isis sat down weeping, saying, Seth has killed Horus, my son. So she fetched a skin of yarn. She fashioned a line and made a harpoon end out of copper. She thrust it into the water at the spot where they submerged. But then the copper barb bites not into Seth, but into Horus. So Horus yells out a shriek and says, Help me, Mother Isis, my mother. Appeal to your copper barb to let go of me. I am Horus, son of Isis. So Isis lets out a shriek and removes her barb by telling it, Let go of him. See, it is my son Horus. He is my child. Then she hurls it back into the water again, this time striking Seth. But now Seth comes up and says, What have I done against you, my sister Isis? Appeal to your copper barb to let go of me. I am your paternal brother. Then she feels exceedingly compassionate towards him. She seems to forget that he actually killed her husband here. But she calls upon her barb, saying, Let go of it. It is my maternal brother who have you bitten into. Now at this, Horus becomes furious at his mother. So he jumps out of the water, and he has a cleaver, and he takes his cleaver, and he takes off Isis's head. He takes in his arms, and he runs into the mountains. Isis, for her part, transforms herself into a statue of flint with no head. And then, noticing this, the All Lord says, or the Universal Lord says, What is that which has arrived having no head? And Thoth tells him, My good lord, that is Isis the Great, the god's mother, after Horus, her son, removed his head. So now the Universal Lord becomes furious about this, and he lets out a cry and says, Let us go and inflict severe punishment upon Horus. So they scour the mountain searching for him. Now he's kind of hiding under a tree, and it's Seth who finds him. So Seth throws him down upon the mountain and rips out his eyes from their sockets, and he buries them in the earth. But then Seth comes away and tells the All-Lord, Oh, I didn't find him. But Hathor, that mistress of the sycamore, the same one who flashed her father earlier, comes about and finds Horus lying weeping. And she captures a gazelle and milks it and puts the milk into the eye. And that actually then restores Horus's eye. And that's, for those of you who've ever seen the Ujjat eye, that idea of the whole, the healed, the healthy eye, you know, we can kind of see that having its origin here, or at least being tied to this myth. The idea of these whole healthy eyes being healed after they had been ripped out by Seth. So his eyes are healed. He looks around, he can see, and Hathor sets out, and she tells the Universal Lord, I found Horus after Seth had deprived him of his eyes, but I have restored them back to health, and see, he has returned. And then the Aeneid says, Let Horus and Seth be summoned in order that they be judged. So they're brought again, right? They're going to judge them again. So here's where the story then takes kind of another one of these bizarre kind of, you know, asides. So the Universal Lord has basically said, look, eat, drink, you know, you guys can't be fighting all the time. And Seth says to Horus, come, let us make a holiday in my house. And this is euphemistically an expression that we also see in love poetry and seems to be a kind of way of saying, you know, having sex. And Horus says to him, I'll do so, surely, I'll do so. Now, it's not clear, and I don't think that's maybe exactly what's meant here. It might just be a play on words. But the text goes on and tells us, Now afterwards, at evening time, bed was prepared for them, and they both lay down. But during the night, Seth caused his phallus to become stiff and inserted it between Horus's thighs. Then Horus placed his hand between his thighs and received Seth's semen. Horus went to tell his mother Isis, Help me, Isis, my mother. Come see what Seth has done to me. And he opened his hand and let her see Seth's semen. She let out a loud shriek and seized a copper knife and cut off his hands. Then she fetched some fragrant ointment, applied it to Horus's phallus, and she caused him to become stiff and inserted it into a pot. And he caused his semen to flow into it. So reading this text, essentially what happens here, and this is at least what I think happens here, is this is another way that Seth is trying to show his dominance over Horus. Is essentially he invites him over for a party and then rapes him. Now, Horus then goes and tells his mother. She cuts off his hands, kind of removing that evidence, that semen, and then takes the odd kind of step of masturbating him into a jar. And we're going to see why in a second. At morning time, Isis went carrying the semen of Horus to the garden of Seth and said to Seth's gardener, "What sort of vegetable is that that Seth eats here in your company?" And so the gardener told her, "He doesn't eat any vegetable here in my company except lettuce." And so Isis added the semen of Horus onto it. Seth returned according to his daily habit and ate the lettuce, which he regularly ate. Thereupon he became pregnant with the semen of Horus. So Seth went to tell Horus, "Come, let's go, that I may contend with you in the tribunal." And Horus said, "I'll do so, surely, I will. And they both went to stand in the presence of the great Aeneid. "Speak concerning yourself." "Let me be awarded the office of ruler," says Seth. "As for Horus, the one who is standing here, I have performed the labor of a male against him." And by the labor of the male, Seth is saying, look, I had my way with this guy last night. He's not strong enough to defend himself against me. I'm far more masculine against him. I've, you know, feminized him by having sex with him. So you should give it to me. Now, we do see text, and there does seem to be, you know, the idea of a homosexuality taboo that does come up. And here we see in the Aeneid's reaction, you know, they let out a loud cry. They spew and they spit in Horus's face. But Horus just laughs at them. And he says, "All that Seth has said is false. Let Seth's semen be summoned, that we may see from where it answers, and my own may be summoned from where we see it answers." So then Thoth, the god of writing, comes and puts a hand on Horus's shoulder and says, "Come out, you semen of Seth." But it answers from the water, by the marsh, because that's where Isis had chopped off his hands and put them. Now then Thoth puts his hand on Seth's shoulder and says, "Come out of you, semen of Seth." And then it says from inside of Seth, "Where shall I come from?" Then Thoth says to it, "Come out from his ear." And then it says, is it from his ear that I should issue forth, seeing that I am divine?" And then Thoth says, "Oh, okay, you know, you're divine. Come out of the top of his head." And so the semen of Horus emerges as a golden solar disk upon Seth's head. And Seth became exceedingly furious and extended his hand to seize the golden solar disk. But Thoth took it straight away from him and placed it upon his own head. And the Aeneid said, "Horus is right and Seth is wrong." So here we can see again Horus, who has these solar connections. His semen comes out as a sun disk, which we often do see, right, represented in Egyptian art. And this is, you know, another trick that clever Isis has pulled. She's tainted the lettuce with Horus's semen and made it now seem as though here's Seth claiming that he's violated Horus, but it's actually Horus who's violated Seth, or at least that's the impression that the Aeneid has. So, of course, what happens? Seth becomes angry, lets out another great cry, and he says, "He shall not be awarded the office until he has been dismissed outside with me, and we build for ourselves some stone ships and race each other. Now, as for the one who shall prevail over his rival, he shall be awarded the office of the ruler." So again, we have another right kind of, you know, contest. Horus builds for himself a boat of pine, however. So he builds a wooden boat and plasters it over with gypsum, and launches it into the water without anybody who is in the entire land having see it. And Seth sees the boat and thinks it's of stone. And so he goes to stone, he cuts off the top of a mountain, and he builds himself a boat of 138 cubits of stone. And a cubit, to give you an idea of a measurement, is about the size from your elbow, your forearm, all the way to the tips of your fingers. That's about a cubit. So he builds a big boat. And they embark upon their ships in the presence of the Aeneid for their race. But Seth's boat sinks in the water. right? And thereupon, Seth transforms himself into a hippo. He charges Seth's boat and destroys it. But Horus takes out a copper harpoon and hurls it at Seth. However, the Aeneid becomes mad at this and says, "Don't hurl it at him." So he gathers all his harpoons. He puts them into his boat, and he sails downstream in order to talk to Neith. So he says, "Neith, let judgment be passed upon me and Seth, seeing that it is 80 years now we have been in the tribunal." It's been a long time, 80 years. "And they have been unable to pass judgment on us, nor has he yet been vindicated against me. But it is 1,000 times now that I have been in the right against him every day, although he doesn't regard anything that the Aeneid has said. I have contended with him in the path of the truth's court. I have been vindicated against him. I have contended with him in Horus with projecting horns court. And I have been vindicated against him. I have contended with him in the field of rushes court. I have been vindicated against him." And goes on and lists all of these courts and all of these situations and settings and saying, "Each time I'm found to be right." So then Thoth makes a statement to the universal Lord and says, "Have a letter sent to Osiris so that he may judge between the two youths." And then Shu, the son of Re, says, "What Thoth has told the Aeneid is correct 1,000,000 times." So the universal Lord says to Thoth, "Sit down and compose a letter to Osiris that we may learn what he has to say." So now they're going to go to the source. They're going to go who used to be the ruler of the world. So they wrote down and they write him a letter and they say, "Bull, the lion who hunts for himself, the two ladies, protecting the gods and subduing the two lands, Horus of gold, who invents mankind in the primeval time, the king of Upper and Lower Egypt, Bull in the midst of Heliopolis, son of Ta, glorious one of the two banks, appearing as father of the Aeneid while he eats gold and glaze, the possessor of sanctity, please write to us what we should do for Horus and Seth so that we do not exercise our authority ignorantly." The next day, the letter reaches the king, and he lets out a loud cry after what had been led in his presence, and he answers them very quickly, saying, "Why should my son Horus be cheated when it was I that made you mighty, and it was I alone who could create barley and emmer in order to sustain the gods and the cattle, as well as the cattle following the gods?" And that means mankind. "Whereas not any god or goddess found himself competent enough to do it." So here Osiris makes a plea kind of like we see with Seth, where he says, you know, "Look, I'm the strong one. I'm the one who did this." Now, Osiris' strength is a little bit different. Going back to our story, when I told you how Osiris was hacked up and they couldn't find everything, well, they found everything but his penis. And his penis, which of course is filled with power and fertility, was actually, you know, supposed to be swallowed up by a Nile fish, but existed in the Nile, and that's what makes the Nile flourishing. And that it's actually from the efflux, the marrow and the blood and the semen and all of those fluids of Osiris from when he was dismembered, that helps to create bounty on the earth. So he's saying, "Look, you all survive by that which I make. So don't deprive my son, give him the office." And once again, we have the letter sent back, and we have the All-Lord who's sitting with the Aeneid, and it's read out in his presence. And the All-Lord says, "Please answer for me the letter very quickly to Osiris, and tell him in the letter, if you had not come into being, and if you had not been born, barley and emmer would exist anyways," right? So the All-Lord takes a bit of offense to this, and he says, "These things don't just exist because of you. You know, they would have existed anyways." So then the letter of the All-Lord reaches Osiris and is read out in his presence. And he again writes to the All-Lord and he says, "It is exceedingly good, all that which you have done. O you who invented the Aeneid as an accomplishment, although justice was allowed to sink down within the netherworld. Please look at the situation also on your part. As for the land in which I am, it is a place filled with savage-faced messengers who do not fear any god or goddess. I have but to let them go forth, and they will fetch the heart of whomever commits misdeeds, and they will be here with me. Indeed, what is the meaning of my happening to be here resting in the west while you are all outside? Who among you is there that is mightier than I? But see, you have invented injustice as an accomplishment. When Ta the Great, south of his wall, Lord of Anktawi, created the sky, isn't it so that he told the stars that are now in it? It is in the west where King Osiris is that where you shall set every night? And he told me, now after the manner of the gods, so patricians and commoners also shall go to rest in the place where you are, so he said to me. So Osiris is saying, you know, I'm in the netherworld with all sorts of monsters. You all are the ones on earth who created injustice and this type of wrongdoing. And I'm filled with these monsters who I can send out who are going to devour the hearts of any who commit these misdeeds. I'm more powerful than all of you, kind of, don't you forget it. Everyone, you know, has been told and been ordered that they will set and die. You know, the stars, the commoners, the nobles, they will come, you know, in the place where I am eventually. So once again, this letter reaches to the All Lord, and they say, the great in bounty, master of sustenance, is doubly correct in all that he has said. So here, right, that great bounty, master of sustenance, they're talking about Osiris and that everything he said has been correct. Then Seth says, let us be taken to the island of the middle, that I may contend with him. And they go to the island of the middle again. And Horus was vindicated against him. Then Atum, lord of the two lands, the Heliopolitan, sent to Isis, saying, bring Seth and restrain him with manacles. So Isis brings Seth in restrained as a prisoner. And Atum says to him, why do you not allow yourself to be judged, but instead usurp for yourself the office of Horus? And Seth says to him, on the contrary, my good lord, let Horus, son of Isis, be summoned and be awarded the office of his father. Horus, son of Isis, is brought, the crown is placed upon his head, and he's installed in the position of his father Osiris. And he's told, you are a good king of Egypt, you are the good lord of every land unto eternity. Thereupon, Isis yells out a yell on behalf of her son, saying, you are the good king, my heart is in joy. You have illuminated the earth with your complexion. And then Ta, the great, says, what shall be done for Seth? For see, Horus has been installed in the position of his father, Osiris. And the Universal Lord says, let Seth, son of Nut, be delivered to me so that he may dwell with me, being in my company as a son, and he shall thunder in the sky and be feared. So they then respond and they say, Horus, son of Isis, has arisen as the ruler. And the All Lord rejoices, and says, you shall jubilate from one land to the next for Horus, son of Isis. Horus has arisen as the ruler. The Aeneid is in festivity, and heaven is in joy. They tell the All Lord, Horus, the son of Isis, has arisen as the ruler. And the All Lord says to the Aeneid, you shall jubilate from one land to the next for Horus, the son of Isis. And Isis says, Horus has arisen as ruler. The Aeneid is in festivity and heaven is in joy. They don wreaths when they saw Horus, son of Isis, arisen as great ruler of Egypt. And as for the Aeneid, their hearts were satisfied, and the entire land was in exultation when they saw Horus, son of Isis, assigned to the office of his father Osiris, the lord of Busiris. And there you have it. That's the entire text. And I've summarized some things and skipped over some things I wasn't just reading. But here you have the tradition. We have, for 80 years, Horus and Seth fighting each other over the rule of the country. And we have lots of these different types of episodes. And we can see from other traditions that these aren't all of the episodes written down here. As I said, we kind of come into the text in the middle, and it's possible that more of them were listed before, but we also see from different sources that we would have had other traditions that went with this. One of the traditions is actually not that Horus is given the entire land, but that Horus and Seth are two brothers who are fighting. And Horus is given Lower Egypt and Seth is given Upper Egypt. And it's the two of them ruling together that unite the two countries. And then, of course, we have within this text the idea that Horus is avenging the injustice done to his father Osiris by his uncle Seth. And so here we see a lawsuit, really, and that they're going through this court. Going back to that idea of myth, right? So there's some entertaining things in here. There's some strange things, certainly. We see, you know, the Hathor flashing her father, the random kind of scene of Seth raping Horus, of Isis masturbating Horus in order to put his semen on lettuce, so that it can then appear that it was actually Horus who raped Seth. I mean, it's definitely a strange tale. But what this does is this kind of does allow us to look at some of the Egyptian values. And what we see here is that it's not a society of might makes right. It's not simply a society where the strongest should rule. In fact, we can see from right when we jump into the story, the tension of, well, what do you do when you have somebody who might be a better fit for king? And it always comes back to this idea of rightful succession, of the son, not the daughter, but the son taking over the office of the father. And that's in a very Egyptian value. There's actually, when we look at ancient Egyptian society, there seems to not be too much social climbing or scheming. There seemed to be an idea that you weren't supposed to go beyond your place. As an Egyptian, it was your job, and what you were meant to do was to inherit the office of your father, to kind of pick up where they left off. And that's what we see here. We also see a beautiful kind of validation of the legal system, although, you know, 80 years might be a bit of excessive. You know, if you've ever had to do anything in our legal system here, you know, it no doubt, makes us seem slightly more efficient, although I only say slightly. So there we have it, the myth of Horus and Seth. And as you can see here, very interesting, it's not a cohesive myth, as you can see. It's a bunch of these strung together, different almost vignettes or small scenes with not much of a narrative thread. And that's a very kind of Egyptian phenomenon. I'm sure at some point I'm going to talk about the myth of Osiris, and that's pieced together much, much better. But it's because the best source we have for that is actually Plutarch. And that's the case for many of these types of things, where we don't have a beautiful written narrative, a nice story kind of from beginning to end dealing with these myths. We have allusions. In the New Kingdom, we start to see a more of an interest in literature, and that's where this comes from, this piece I read today. And that's where we see, or at least I think we see, more of an interest in producing kind of these written documents. And there's no doubt in my mind that this is the type of thing which, although possessing it would have been, you know, a sign of kind of culture, this would be the type of thing that was no doubt kind of meant to be read. These small stories are stitched together as from various, I think, oral tales and oral traditions that we would have had from various towns that would have been performed, that would have been the type of thing that individuals really enjoyed. So there you have it, the myth of Horus and Seth. Hopefully you enjoyed it if you've never heard it before. Again, as I said, it's a very strange tale, but one that just kind of I was thinking about and thought was interesting, and hopefully you all find it interesting as well. Have a great day. Thanks for listening.